From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine, and joining me on the show today are Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor for CNN Politics Digital, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics, and here are the issues. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel won re-election in an upset, assuming, that is, that he is able to put together a majority coalition. In response, the Obama administration expressed its concern over Netanyahu's statement that a Palestinian state would not be established while he is prime minister, a statement he later softened. The administration also is considering actions to reduce its support for Israel. In Switzerland, negotiators seeking an agreement to limit Iran's nuclear program clashed over Iran's insistence that sanctions against Iran be quickly removed. And in Tunisia, 20 foreign tourists were killed by terrorists whom the Islamic State identified as its fighters. Well, the big news, Stephen, of course, is the election in Israel and the response of the Obama administration. And I think we have to say at the beginning, while Israel and the United States have been great allies, that President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu are not great friends. What about the election, and why was it an upset?
Right. It's interesting. There's a bit of symmetry here, in a way, because before the last presidential election, Benjamin Netanyahu was openly rooting for President Obama to lose, and he won. And the same thing has happened here. It's clear that the White House didn't want Netanyahu to win this election, and were quite cheered, in fact, by the polls beforehand, which suggested that, you know, Netanyahu could even lose. Even Netanyahu himself said, whether he was being sincere or whether it was a ploy, that we could lose this election. In the end, he actually won by a clearer margin, than larger plurality than even the polls suggested right at the end there. You know, it seems like the Israeli public, or enough of them at least, embraced his message that security, Iran, you know, the dangerous neighborhood that Israel is living in, was more important than the big economic questions that, that a lot of the more sort of moderate and left-wing parties were hoping would carry them to election. So it's very interesting. I think we're going to be set for, barring some massive crisis that brings Israel and the United States together, another war with Hamas, for example, something like that, a very rough 2 years in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. If there's a deal with Iran that, you know, Netanyahu is going to come out and be very adamantly against it. If there's no deal, I think you're going to find members of the Obama administration blaming Netanyahu and his alliance with Republicans for scuttling it.
Hillary, you know, one of the things that I'm a little confused about with Netanyahu, who's not going to be around for a few more years as prime minister, one of the main jobs of the prime minister of Israel, if not the main job, is to get along with the president of the United States. And how will this work now? Because obviously Netanyahu and Obama don't get along at all.
They don't get along very well. It's actually amazing the undiplomatic language that the two sides have been willing to publicly, on the record, say. But actually, Netanyahu would say that his main job is to protect the people of Israel and that Obama's policies are simply dangerous for Israel. I mean, he sees the deal that's coming together with Iran as one that is a terrible deal for Israel, that is essentially saying to Iran, over the course of this 10-year agreement, we're going to allow Iran to keep enough of its facilities in place and to be really ready to break out in a pretty short time. And he sees that as an existential threat to Israel. So he thinks that it's important to be, you know, even if it means ruffling feathers with the White House, to really be standing up for Israel and stating what Israel needs and being willing to take on anybody in the world who's going to be taking a different view on what the region needs and that kind of thing. But certainly the Israeli people want to have a good relationship with the United States. The United States is a very important ally, and it's not just about actually the military support and the aid that's given to Israel. It's the sense of having a friend in the world, and Israel feels quite isolated. And actually, the efforts at the United Nations that have been trying to isolate Israel even further are gathering a lot of steam. They could have some practical implications in terms of giving power to Palestinians. They want to get a state essentially established established through the UN. But again, it's more than that. It's the question of, will Israel be boycotted? Will there be sanctions? Will it be seen as a pariah nation? And the U.S. has been the country that's been vetoing a lot of resolutions against Israel at the UN, and just more importantly, bolstering Israel on the world stage. And so now there's a real question about whether that support is going to be lost. And I think when you heard White House officials start to say, yeah, we're not necessarily going to be as supportive of Israel at the UN right after Netanyahu won this election, that's when you heard Netanyahu come out and say, well, on a Palestinian state, you know, mm-hmm. I am a supporter of a two-state solution. You know, don't be so hasty to judge what I said during the campaign. I mean, that's not exactly how he said it, but that was certainly the essence of what was happening. And so that threat carried a lot of weight. And there's a question now of how much Netanyahu will be able to manage the difficult relationship he has with the White House.
Well, that is the big question. And, you know, one of the issues, of course, is that Hillary was referring to is the statement that Netanyahu made in the closing days of the campaign that as long as he's prime minister, there would not be a Palestinian state. And he did soften that later. On the other hand, there probably wasn't going to be a Palestinian state anyway.
Right. This is
at least while Netanyahu's prime minister.
Right. This is one of those occasions when, you know, in campaigns, things get said which what they actually mean is one thing and what the actual impact of what they say is another.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody objectively looking at the actions of the last few years could seriously think that Netanyahu was in any way pushing for a Palestinian state under his tenure, that it would be his, you know, number one legacy issue. Neither the Israeli or Palestinian publics seem to me to be in a place where they would be willing to make the kind of concessions that you would need to get to that state. I think that, you know, Netanyahu's actions in terms of allowing the expansion of settlements, for example, undermine any sort of political credibility the Palestinian leadership would have in doing a deal with Israel. The other thing is, you know, for years, the argument of people that back the peace process is that if you do get to a Palestinian state, you end that conflict, then a lot of the other problems in the Middle East go away. The situation now is we've seen the rise of ISIS, splintering states all around Israel, places like Syria. You know, we've seen the disaster that's unfolding in Iraq, the rising hegemony of Iran all over the Middle East. Just outside the key stakeholders, there is less momentum and political sort of rationale to push for a Middle East peace process. You know, it seems like one of the few people that thought that was even possible in the last few years was John Kerry, and we saw how his peace mission ended up. So Netanyahu can say he's for a Palestinian state or against a Palestinian state, but in the end, it doesn't matter that much because nobody that I can see thinks there's going to be a Palestinian state soon at any time.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show today are Stephen Collinson, who you just heard, and Hillary Krieger, both of CNN Politics. And now this program announcement.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hillary, what about the political repercussions in the United States if, under the Obama presidency, that the U.S. does sort of pull back from its support for Israel? I mean, Israel has a lot of friends in the United States. They aren't all Jewish by any means. Every poll shows that. What about that?
Well, the polls also show that among that support, it's much larger among Republicans than among Democrats. And while Israel has traditionally been a bipartisan issue, it's actually been one of the few places that Congress has been willing to come together and pass resolutions and support and share, you know, the same statements and that kind of thing. What you're seeing is certainly among the American electorate a bit of a shift in the Democratic Party, where Democrats are tending to be a bit more skeptical of Israeli intentions, more supportive of the Palestinians, and the Democratic leadership has been very strong in support of Israel and sort of trying to hold the line against that trend and maintain a bipartisan support. But what's happened now between Netanyahu and Obama has been such a partisan split in the sense that Netanyahu really angered Obama by coming to speak to Congress a couple of weeks ago and really rail against Obama's Iran plan at the invitation of John Boehner, the speaker, who's Republican and looking to woo Jewish voters and Jewish donors over to more formally in the Republican Party. Jews have historically voted Democrat, and that's shifting as well as Jews become more Orthodox and the Orthodox identify more with the right. And so I think this really can exacerbate those trends. And you've seen a lot of Democrats in Congress who want to be supportive of Israel really upset that they feel that they have to stand behind their president, that the way Netanyahu is treating him is disrespectful. And on, you know, a vote when it comes to the Iran sanctions, for instance, where you might have had a lot of Democrats joining with Republicans to call for more accountability from the White House and a bigger role and say in what's happening with this deal, Democrats feel in terms of their allegiance to the president, to their party, that that's not something they'll necessarily be able to do. So I think that that could really mean that there's some political fallout when it comes to Democratic support for Israel.
Stephen, I want to jump back and sort of evaluate one thing briefly, and that is the speech that Speaker Boehner invited Netanyahu to come and give, which he did on March 3rd. The White House had put a lot of pressure on Netanyahu, not on Boehner, but on Netanyahu not to come, and he did anyway. There was a thought at the time that maybe that would backfire on Netanyahu, and, you know, with his reelection, it looks like it didn't.
Right. It clearly didn't backfire on Netanyahu in Israel. A lot of people in the White House were hoping that maybe it would. You mentioned earlier the need for Israeli prime ministers to always keep good relationships with the United States.
Well, particularly with the president.
Right, exactly. And I don't know yet that we can really evaluate the political implications from this side of the Atlantic. Boehner's heading off to Israel to take a victory lap in the next few weeks. I think it's, you know, something that's could be seen perhaps as a political victory for him. You know, he's sitting atop a very restive coalition. I don't think I've ever seen the GOP in the House so united as when they were standing up cheering Benjamin Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. You know, and that can be something that Boehner can be quite happy about. I think in terms of the relationship with the White House, it may be the final thing that, you know, really broke that relationship. It's one thing if Netanyahu...
The relationship between Boehner? Between
Netanyahu and the... the relationship between Boehner and the White House is
already
long since fractured.
Yeah.
But it's one thing for Netanyahu to make clear his, you know, disdain for the potential Iran deal in the United Nations, around the world, in Israel. But to come into the second most prominent pedestal for a foreign leader in, you know, in Washington after the Oval Office, and to openly side with the opposition, the Republican opposition to the president, I think is something that political people in the White House aren't going to forget very quickly. And, you know, I think they were hoping for vengeance in the election, but that doesn't mean they can't make life uncomfortable for Netanyahu in the next couple of years.
They certainly can. But Hillary, I want to turn to the subject that is that was the subject actually of Netanyahu's speech mainly, and that is a deal that's being negotiated now by the U.S. and the Iranians and European countries over putting curbs on the Iranian nuclear program. And now the Iranians, or so it's been reported, are demanding they want to have it once they sign a deal. They want the sanctions to be lifted immediately, even before whether their compliance with a deal has been certified.
Iranians have made pretty clear from the beginning that getting rid of the sanctions is their number one goal. Certainly the fact that they even came to the table only happened when the sanctions got really tough and was really hurting their economy. So that's, you know, clearly their position that they've been pushing for from the beginning. I think that this has been a chronic disagreement throughout the process of negotiation. I don't think this is something that's just coming up at this moment. I think what's happening...
Well, it's still an impediment, though.
It's absolutely an impediment. What's happened is there have been other places where they've been able to find a little bit more agreement, and they sort of focused on finding the agreement so that they could have some progress. And now that it's coming down to the last couple of weeks before the end of the month deadline for a framework deal, they need to resolve all the issues enough to be able to have this framework and then hammer out all the final little precise details by the end of June, which is the ultimate deadline for a deal. And that's when these things are coming to a head. What the administration is saying is that Iran needs to show that they've actually, you know, are taking the steps that they said that they would take, that there's, you know, an ability of the UN to go in and conduct inspections and really be able to monitor what's happening, and that without keeping some of the sanctions in place, that there's no leverage on Iran and they can't be trusted sufficiently given their history of violating previous types of commitments on nuclear issues to lift some of these sanctions. But what you also saw American officials say was that they see that they also need to be able to do something in terms of sanctions relief up front that is significant enough to give Iranians a sense of political victory. They need to be able to sell this deal to their public, and if they don't have some level of sanctions relief that they can immediately show people, that's going to be problematic. So there are definitely some signs from the administration that they're trying to find a space of accommodation here and that they understand some of where the Iranians are coming from on the issue.
I'm going to take another quick break here before I get to you, Stephen. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Joining me today on the show are Stephen Collinson and Hillary Krieger, both of CNN Politics. Jump in here on the whole question of Iran and negotiations. You know, in the next, you'll probably be covering this, in the next few days, Republicans will be drafting a bill, Bob Corker of Tennessee, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a bill that would require that the president submit any deal with Iran to Congress for its approval or disapproval.
Right. It's been a...
And, of course, the president says, no, he'll veto that.
Right. Well, there's this big debate going on about whether this deal with Iran is a treaty or an executive agreement that doesn't require Congress, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The big question about the Iran deal all along has been whether more hawkish political forces in Washington and in Tehran would allow it to take place. I think, you know, presuming there's not a majority, a supermajority that would override a presidential veto, if there is a deal that takes place, I think the president has the authority and the capacity to sort of lift enough sanctions to keep it going until the end of his presidency. The real crisis point, if there is a deal, is going to come after that period when the president is no longer in office. He can't block Congress's chances to overturn the deal. There's a possibility that a Republican president could come in and say, I didn't make this deal and I don't plan to honor it. Marco Rubio said this week he'd do exactly that if he was elected, the Republican from Florida.
That's what Rick Perry of Texas said as
right.
well.
Having said that, in practice, I don't think it's clear that even a Republican president, if a deal was working, which is a huge caveat, if Iran is seen to be at least complying with most of the deal, that a Republican president would come along and defy the other members of the international community that have negotiated this deal and just say, okay, we're going to wipe this away. First of all, I think it would be very difficult for the United States to get European partners to reimpose the kind of sanctions we've seen in Iran that have brought it to the table in that event. And secondly, he would be saddling himself with a massive foreign policy crisis, which could conceivably lead to military action against Iran at the beginning of his presidency, which would completely overwhelm everything else he was mm-hmm. trying to do. So that's what the administration is banking on, is if, okay, if we can get a deal and we can get Iran to comply, or at least look like it's complying, it's going to be it's going to be a lot tougher than Republicans are now saying to overturn that deal. But, you know, I think history suggests that if there is a deal, Iran will press right up to the red lines, you know, as soon as it can to test the administration resolve, and could easily see a new crisis in the next administration.
You know, I remember the deal that was followed by the first President Bush back in 1991, where he submitted going to war against Iraq and Saddam Hussein to the Senate and the House. They both approved it. But his position, at least privately, was even if they'd said no, I was going to do it anyway. So I want to turn, because we don't have much time left, to Tunisia and this terrorist attack on foreign tourists there in particular. That's one of the sources of income for the Tunisian government, obviously, and the citizens there from tourists. But the scary thing about it, I think, Hillary, is that this is the one country that seemed to have that's where the Arab Spring started and has actually landed on its feet. Now other countries have struggled.
Right. I mean, this is definitely a direct attack on the government as much as it was on a place where there were foreigners and Westerners, where, you know, you have a secular government that's wanted to provide some sense of inclusivity, some sense of inclusiveness that allows for a more flourishing and open society going forward. I mean, like you said, Tunisia is where the Arab Spring started. It was out for popular frustration. It wasn't as motivated as we've seen in other places by some of the religious and sectarian issues. And they were able to create a much more hopeful environment than we've seen certainly in Libya next door or what's happened in Egypt. I think that, you know, ISIS, which is taking responsibility for this, it's still not exactly clear that that's what happened. But certainly you have a group that wants to show that it can disrupt governments, you know, in a wide, wide swath of areas. So now they've arrived in this attack in Tunisia and expanded sort of the front of the campaign and really showing that if, you know, you're going to be trying to set up a government that isn't in line with their values, you're going to be seen as a threat and they're going to strike at the heart of the economy where they can, where it can be painful. And I think it you know, really just is like is one more cut in a very long line of attacks that have shown that the effort to have a rejuvenated Middle East, that the forces looking towards a more of an open and democratic society have a huge challenge in front of them.
Well, certainly, Stephen, ISIS seems to have quite a reach. And I remember the takeover of, what was it, a coffee shop or something in Australia a few months ago, and now Tunisia, which was the real prize in the Arab Spring.
Right, yeah. Tunisia was the, you know, the cradle of the Arab Spring, mm-hmm. where the whole thing started out. And you're right about these increasing attacks, the reach of ISIS. You know, every time you get one of these attacks, all the world leaders come out and condemn it and say it's, you know, unacceptable, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing really gets done to sort of stem the rise of these ISIS-inspired attacks. They may not even be, you know, core ISIS, whatever that is, but just people that are radicals that are inspired by ISIS's actions. I think the worrying thing for Western intelligence and Western leaders is that it's clear now that anybody can just get a gun and cause a massacre anywhere. We've seen it in France. We saw the attack in Ottawa. You mentioned the one in Sydney. You just need a gun now and a couple of committed radicals and you can cause havoc, and these things are almost impossible to stop. So it really has a sort of potential to change the Western way of life. I mean, cruise ships have been going into Tunisia for years.
I've been on one, actually, just a couple of years
right,
ago.
Right, and now they're not going to be calling in Tunisia mm-hmm. anymore. That's going to have, you know, very destabilizing impacts on the Tunisian economy. So, you know, there's no real reason why if this could happen in Tunisia, it couldn't happen in mm-hmm. the UK, the United States, other Western countries. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that happens, the more it's going to concentrate the debate on what do we do about Syria. Has the fact that the West has not been involved more in Syria allowed this kind of action to spread, for people to take inspiration from the success of ISIS? So I think this is going to be a really big story in the next couple of years.
Well, it's something that, you know, I'm sympathetic to the French. Remember what the French said after the attack there? You know, well, we had these guys under surveillance who did the attack on the French magazine and killed 10 or 12 people. But they said, you know, we don't have enough officers to be surveilling all these hundreds and hundreds of people that we have as listed and as potential terrorists. And you can't do that in Tunisia or anywhere else, or you turn your entire government into intelligence officers, Hillary.
I mean, it's definitely a challenge. And I think one of the things that's happened with these attacks coming, especially into Western countries, is that you've seen a bit of a mindset shift in America, mm-hmm. where you had a very war-weary country not wanting to be involved in the Middle East, not wanting to see, you know, more American troops deployed, especially not on the ground going back to Iraq, places like that. And Americans, I think, feel a sense now that they're still at risk. 9/11 isn't over. And what's happening with ISIS is so extreme, and what they're doing is also so bloody and vividly violent that it's really horrified the American people. And I think you now see a frustration among Americans that the government isn't doing more, that there isn't more aggressive actions, and that some of the things that I think were politically untenable a year or 2 years ago are now being thought about and talked about. And there's a shift that means that as difficult as these challenges are, as Stephen pointed to, there might be more done to try and meet them.
Well, thank you. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, Enterprise Editor at CNN Politics Digital, and Stephen Collinson, Senior Reporter at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Pete Hudley. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard Magazine. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.